in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, July 14th, 2014. And today we are talking about two things I love, and that would be economics and The Simpsons. With Joshua Hall, who is associate professor of economics at West Virginia University. He's formerly an economist for the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. He is currently the president of the Association of Private Enterprise Education. He's also a co-author of the widely cited Economic Freedom of the World reports and author of over 50 articles in journals. But most importantly, for our purposes, he is the editor of a wonderful new book called Homer Economicus, The Simpsons and Economics. Josh Hall, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
I love the anecdote, the very beginning of your book, talking about how this project got started, and Professor McCloskey saying to you about your proposed article called Homer Economicus. A title like that deserves a book. I thought exactly the same thing when I heard it the first time, but by that time I knew it was going to be a book. But as somebody who is the world's worst book title generator, but yet can appreciate a good title when he sees one, I was thrilled when I heard that, because The Simpsons and economics are basically the two loves of my life here in terms of popular culture and academics. So to see them brought together in a book was really exciting. What made you think to use The Simpsons as a way of illustrating economics in the first place?
Well, Tom, I'm not a big TV watcher. My family and I, we maybe choose one show and just go through it. But one of the constants in our lives has been The Simpsons. And in fact, my eldest son's middle name is kind of taken from The Simpsons. His name is Hamilton J. Hall. And that is also Homer's middle name.
Right.
And when we were sitting down thinking of, what would be Hamilton? That's a mouthy first name. We need something short. And the episode where Homer never knows what his middle name is, he thinks it's just J period, and he finds out his middle name is actually J, J-A-Y.
Right.
I had these examples at my fingertips, and I like to give a serious example in class, and then a more frivolous example to show, and it seems to resonate with different students in a different way. And there's just so much good material in there.
There are a bunch of people who are featured in this book whom we've had as guests here, and I didn't realize that, of course, the apex of their work is what appears in this book, and I should be talking to them about that the next time they come on here. Once you're off the air with me, I'm going to actually go through and read all the chapter titles to everybody, because that, I think, will whet their appetites to see just how much can be illustrated by way of The Simpsons, beginning with the general approach to economics, the economic way of thinking, and then going all the way through a whole bunch of subfields of economics. Believe it or not, it's all there. Before we got on the air, actually, I was saying to you that it was funny for me to read the chapter on health economics and to recall, because there are just so many wonderful Simpsons memories that I have. I could talk about it for hours. But in particular, the episode in which Homer's applying for health insurance, and he's filling out the form, and the gentleman on the other side is saying, well, let's see here, under heart attacks, you wrote 3, crossed that out and put 0. And then Homer replies, says, oh, I thought it said brain hemorrhages. I mean, the show full of remarks like that. And this is why people like us constantly watch it, because it really is so good. Now, let's talk about, though, your choice to make this a collection of essays by independent people instead of Josh Hall taking his lifelong accumulation of Simpsons anecdotes and writing the book himself.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm selfish here. So the book kind of got a little scathing review in Business Week. I'm not exactly sure why. It just wasn't his cup of tea, but one of the things he said, he kind of jokingly said I was lazy in having it do an edited volume. I like to think I was selfish in that I really wanted to hear what other people had to say on this. I mean, I know why I find the anecdote you talked about amusing, but I want to know what a health economist and how a health economist might use that. And so when, you know, I said, okay, now's the time. The time's right. I have a tenure-track job. You know, I have this nice summer fellowship. I can get started on this. I'm going to email just a bunch of people I know and say, hey, do you use Simpsons in the classroom at all, these anecdotes? Would you be willing to write a chapter? I'd really like to see the way you approach it. And it was such a pleasure to read these coming in because I knew that example, but I wouldn't have used it in that way. And my favorite example of that is the chapter on money. And Andy Young, he's now a colleague of mine at West Virginia University, he uses one quote from Milhouse where Milhouse says, I can't go to juvie. They use guys like me for currency in juvie. And from that quote, he then says, in what ways can we say Milhouse is like currency? Well, first we have to ask, what properties does currency have? And from that quote, he just spins out, I think, a fantastic chapter. And so it's the only thing that's not kind of pure micro in the text. I mean, I think that's something your listeners should know. It's really just kind of basic microeconomics.
Right.
Simpsons touches on more macro stuff, but it's all about human behavior, and that's something the Simpsons is great at poking fun at. I mean, that's a nice thing. Either they're, it's not that the Simpsons, like, agrees with good economics in all cases, but even in making bad economics, that's a teachable moment.
Well, there are some funny political asides that are made occasionally that cut both ways. They spare nobody, although I do recall Abraham Simpson, the grandfather, walking down the street talking about what a bunch of lazy bums the current generation is, and they expect things to be handed to them. And then he turns to the Social Security office, walks in and says, I'm old, gimme, gimme, gimme.
Yeah.
Now, I like, by the way, that money chapter is called $20 Can Buy Many Peanuts. And Homer's sitting on the couch, and a peanut falls under the couch, and he's reaching under to find that one peanut. Instead, he finds a $20 bill, and he says, oh, I wanted a peanut. And his brain says to him, $20 can buy many peanuts. And he barks at his brain, explain how. And his brain says, money can be exchanged for goods and services. And then he cheers. I mean, again, you could just go on forever talking about this show. You have a chapter in here by a friend of this program, Mark Thornton, who is a scholar of prohibition. And, of course, Homer was involved in bootlegging for a time. So can you hit on that a bit?
Yeah, this is another example of someone I reached out to. And I don't know if I'm telling tales of school, but Mark wasn't a huge Simpsons fan. And as I understand, hadn't actually seen that episode. So
oh.
I said, well, how have you not seen? Somebody's got to brought this to your attention. So I overnighted him the season of the DVDs.
There you go. Good.
And he said, yes, I will do this. There's so much to talk about. Because they get all of the key kind of facts that you would expect from Prohibition, right? People switch from, you know, beer to harder spirits. Homer starts brewing, you know, bathtub gin in his basement. You know, the law enforcement is cracking down on all sorts of other behaviors. I mean, it's just, there's even though nobody agrees with the law, this 200-plus-year-old law they have in the books, well, it's the law. We have to follow it, at least publicly, right?
Right, yeah.
Privately, we're going to go to the speakeasy and pay $40 in juleps.
All right, I'm just looking down the list of these. I had a chance to glance at the book last night, which, by the way, before we continue, I want to tell people that this is not only an enjoyable read for yourself, but I think this is a great gift idea, more than pretty much any book we've discussed on this show, because everybody knows somebody who loves The Simpsons. And maybe you may say to yourself, well, they like The Simpsons, but they're not so interested in economics. Exactly. This is how you speak to those people and bring them into our crazy cult of economics world. You know, I mean, this is how you draw them in, by making this connection.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I mean, that's kind of why I didn't... This project has been a long time coming. It was very quick writing. From the time I asked people to do chapter, I mean, 3 months, it's not quite your writing pace, Tom, but it was very quick before
The
chapters came in, and because people love doing it, the process of getting a publisher and everything else, and I just kept at it because somebody sent me years ago The Simpsons and Philosophy, and, you know, I think if you're going to be a serious economist, you kind of have to have some interest, at least in the philosophy of science, and I just enjoyed learning about some philosophy through that book, and I thought, and somebody just gave it to me as a Christmas present because they knew I was a Simpsons fan.
Now,
that would be the ultimate outcome for me, is if that's the way this got into people.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there should be a really heavy Christmas push, and if you send me an email and remind me, I'll remind my people, don't forget now, open some important doors for people while giving them a lot of pleasure and enjoyment by checking this out. Now, you mentioned looking for a publisher, and it looks here as if you've got Stanford as your publisher, and it's a book on The Simpsons. How'd that work out?
It worked out. I had initially gone, you know, you're at a conference and you're talking to publishers, and I had some conversations with one of the kind of more, let's just say, academic publishers, but not a university press, and we actually had a contract, and they were coming out with a kind of a lower-priced line, not the usual kind of $100 academic titles. And so, because I wanted it to be something that would get into people's hands and would be reasonably priced, and contractually, we just could not get a sign-off from 20th Century Fox the way the book was currently written. More importantly, we were kind of too small potatoes for them to even engage with us.
Oh.
So I shopped the manuscript around. It was more like, it wasn't that they didn't want to work with us. It's, you know, the rights for it might be at most a couple thousand dollars. It's not even worth their lawyer's time of picking up the phone.
Yeah.
And as luck would have it, through a mutual friend, the manuscript got sent to Stanford University Press, and they're like, oh, I love it. Publisher's a big fan of The Simpsons, and their lawyers knew somebody at 20th Century Fox, and suddenly all the problems disappeared. And so there really was, it was one of those things where you're like, I understand intellectually why we can't get, you know, a serious response to this, but it's still very frustrating. I mean, it was basically a four-year process, and it couldn't have worked out better. Stanford University Press has been fantastic. I think the book is priced right. It looks great. The cover for your readers, it's a donut and a penny coming from the donut and the back on a chalkboard, and I think this, while being serious enough that it has value to both the reader and to the people who put the chapters in there, but yet with the distribution and marketing of a very good university press.
One drawback, though, is that in terms of marketing, though, if you had a publisher like Doubleday or Random House or something, they would have, I think, better connections to the mainstream book-buying world than a university press does. And I think they would be able to put marketing money that, you know, might be able to reach those people a little bit better than university presses have typically been able to do. On the other hand, you have the prestige of a university press.
Yeah, I think, I just don't think that part of the publishing world is interested in, I made some attempts in that part of the world, and I know other people who do the kind of popular culture and philosophy, and they've made overtures in that area, because The Simpsons philosophy, now this was some time ago, and the book publishing industry's changed quite a bit, but sold over 200,000 copies. So you would think that might be something they'd be interested in, and it really didn't turn out to be the case.
Yeah,
so
I
agree with you.
I think the
that.
Word economics, though, I think what's getting them is the word economics sounds like sales poison to them.
Yeah, unless you're one of these people who has some sort of track record the Freakonomics or
right.
Tim Hartford or someone like that. Yeah.
And you know what? I mean, maybe they're right about that. You and I do live in a bit of a bubble where everybody we talk to loves this stuff and can't get enough of it. Maybe they do know what they're doing, but I sort of feel like this sort of title could have been a breakthrough. But I mean, look, you got Stanford University Press behind you. How can you complain?
Yeah, I don't think you can. And again, they're I think we're going to see a real shift. I mean, there's so much shakeout in the university presses. The ones that are doing, I mean, there's it's not quite the double days and offs of the world, but Princeton University Press, I think Stanford University Press, at least in economics, really are so much more market driven than they used to be in a good way in terms of marketing and promotion. You know, the first question they're asking you is, okay, what sort of media have you done? How many Twitter followers do you have? I mean, they know, you know, and they've come back and forth. It's not, they don't just live in that university press world anymore.
I have three people, all of whom I know, collaborated on the chapter on entrepreneurship in The Simpsons. And that's a good example of how the book works, because it's not saying that The Simpsons is a anarcho-capitalist world or anything like that, but it's saying that economic concepts are illustrated in The Simpsons. And the key example in this chapter is when Ned Flanders opens the Leftorium, which is a store catering to left-handed people who are always left out, so to speak, and who, for example, have trouble finding different implements that are suitable for left-handed people. And he spots a niche that no one else has seen before, and he risks his own savings to go out there and cater to that niche. And eventually, oddly enough, with Homer's help, of all people, it works out. And this is a central – this is entrepreneurship. I mean, this is the entrepreneurship 101.
And I think that you've hit on one of the reasons why any sort of narrative, and whether it's a narrative in a sitcom like The Simpsons or in a movie, works well in the hands of a good economics instructor who thinks about markets as a process, right? Where, you know, someone like Ned has this incentive because he feels frustrated and willing to put his own capital on the line. We can see that occurring right before our eyes, right? And you don't have that in a lot of kind of standard non-narrative, at least where the students can bring that narrative to them. I don't know, either I try not to get to the, it seems to me as I get older, I'm falling more and more into the curmudgeonly trap about kids don't know anything nowadays, but I do think, if you look at the data about like youth unemployment, I worked from age 10 onward, you know, had a small business, and then when I finally convinced someone to hire me at 13, I work for other people. My students, in large part, don't have a lot of real work experience. If they do, it's something that's extremely corporate, where there's no link between their individual effort in the near term and the reward they get. And so when you talk about the difficulty that like small businesses have of starting, it's so foreign to them because they have no experience. It's something they've never even thought about. Right. I worked at McDonald's a little bit, and it's just so abstract versus, you know, I worked in small businesses all my life, and you could see the difficulty the owner was going through and trying to make ends meet. And do I introduce this new product? But I can't. The menu's getting too large, and the too unwieldy. But I take that off, I lose these longtime customers who come in every Friday and get that. And students don't have that, so the narrative helps kind of fill that in if they know and understand those characters.
Exactly. And, of course, the other things that you have to deal with would be if I want to expand some part of my business, or if I want to expand just, I often give this as an example, the customer service division. Well, your average kid who doesn't give this much thought thinks, yes, of course you need more customer service, but not necessarily. Everything comes at a cost. I have to withdraw the resources I'm going to use in customer service from some other part of the business, and I have to weigh these things against each other. Then meanwhile, there's always the prospect that government will come along, inspired by people who think that I'm nothing but a cash cow to be milked, and I have to factor that into my plans for the future. it is indeed very, very difficult. And if you have no direct experience with it, it's much more likely that you're going to treat businesses this way, contemptuously and just as resources to be exploited.
Well, this is why I do think kind of youth, both the regulatory state and you know, combined with minimum wage laws and everything else that conspire against youth, as well as I think parents downplaying the role of work and more about other sorts of kind of achievements, are really going to have long-term consequences in people's attitudes. It's not only, first of all, I think it's good for the soul of the individuals to work, and a real sense of accomplishment can come from a job well done. But setting aside that, it really affects their views on business, and then their view about public policy towards those businesses. Oh, why can't they just absorb those costs? I mean, phrases that anybody who's ever had a real involvement in business would know. No, I mean, those are big, weighty decisions.
I feel like I want to actually go through the chapters with you still here, if you don't mind. I want
sure
people
thing.
To hear this. And it's so wonderful because I know at least half these people, and so that makes me want to delve into it all the more as soon as I got it. And the first person is Tony Carilli. I thought, oh, that's great. Okay, so we've got Scarcity, Specialization, and Squishies, The Simpsons as Homo Economicus, Where the Invisible Hand Has Only Four Fingers, Supply, Demand, and the Market Process in Springfield, A Pile of Krusty Burgers Embiggens the Fattest Man, Obesity, Incentives, and Unintended Consequences in King Size Homer. And then, of course, there's $20 Can Buy Many Peanuts, Money and the Simpsons. Thank You, Come Again, The Pursuit of Profits in Springfield. They have the internet on computers now? Entrepreneurship in the Simpsons. I've Got a Monopoly to Maintain, Market Failure in the Simpsons. Will You Stop That Infernal Racket? Externalities in The Simpsons. Mayors, Monorails, and Morons, Government Failure in The Simpsons. Coming to Homerica, The Economics of Immigration. Donut and Dimed, Labor Markets in Springfield. Paging Dr. Hibbert, What The Simpsons Can Teach Us About Health Economics. At first I thought Prohibition was a good thing, The Economics of Alcohol Control. Mr. Burns Casino, The Economics of Casino Gambling. Homer Economicus or Homer Sapiens, Behavioral Economics in The Simpsons. And then From Rabbit Ears to Flat Screen, It's Getting Better All the Time. Now, I can't imagine anybody not wanting to read this. I can't live in that world, Josh, that there would be a world where somebody would not want to read this. But before I let you go, I guess I just feel compelled to do this. Sometimes there are voices I can do, and the voices I can do are always the peripheral characters of whatever the show is. So I can actually do the comic book store guy, and I think I'm going to do that for you and the audience. And you critique me, but I'm pretty sure I can do this. So I haven't done it in a very long time, but it runs something like this. Yes, I would like to return your quote-unquote ultimate belt. Do you have a receipt, quote-unquote, sir? No, I do not have a receipt. I won it as a door prize at the Star Trek convention. However, I find their choice of prize highly illogical, as the average Trekker has no use for a medium-sized belt. There you go, Josh.
That was great.
I appreciate that. All dignity has been reduced to zero here on the show. Well, I really appreciate your time. Best of luck with this. Do you have a web presence anywhere where people can follow you?
They can follow me on Twitter at Joshua_C_Hall. And if they Google Joshua Hall, I think I'm the first thing that comes up. And they can find more of my writings on economic freedom and other things they might be interested in as well. So,
well, again, brilliant title, excellent book, great gift idea for yourself or for that Simpsons lover you know. And in fact, it can convert people both to sound economics and to The Simpsons. You can use it both ways. So, Josh, thanks for your time today. Best of luck with this.
Okay, thanks so much, Tom.
All right, just a few show notes before I let you guys go today. I want to let you know what my plans are as the month goes on. The very end of the month, July 28th, I want to make that week World War I week because it will have been 100 years since the official outbreak of that war on July 28th, and that war had so many lasting consequences for the world, and I want to talk about some of those consequences in that week. So I've already got several guests lined up you're going to love that will give us some great history, some great analysis of this crucial event. So I hope you'll make sure and tune in, especially for World War I week that I'll have coming up. The week before that, I'll be in Auburn, Alabama, teaching at the Mises University week-long summer program there that the Mises Institute puts on. But fear not, there will be programs all that week. And then, coming up later this week, we've got tomorrow we're going to have Bob Murphy giving us his analysis of what's going on at the Fed in light of recent news. Wednesday, Jason Jewell of Faulkner University will take us through the concept of social justice, in quotation marks, of course. Then Thursday, it's Charles Calamiris of Columbia Business School on his new book on banking crises and why they in fact have political origins. Then finally on Thursday, from Columbia Law School, it's Philip Hamburger talking about his book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? A great week, a great month of programming. If you're enjoying these programs and you appreciate what's being done here, become a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com and get transcripts of all the interviews, plus discounts at Liberty retailers around the internet, 60% off at mylibertyclassroom.com, plus many more goodies to come. My next book, the ebook, will be available to you guys for free, plus the audiobook will be available to you guys for free, plus all kinds of other goodies. My homeschool courses I'm doing for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program at ronpaulhomeschool.com will be available to those of you at the upper ends of the program. I have a lot of things planned, goodies that'll come out on a semi-regular basis for people who support the show. This won't be like a PBS umbrella. You donate $250, you get an umbrella. No, I want you to get real, real stuff in exchange for helping me out here and giving me a budget to promote the show. Because otherwise, all I've got is word of mouth, which, by the way, ain't too shabby, because you guys have really been spreading the word about the show, linking to it on social media and stuff, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.